how we need to respond to what God has said. And in doing that this morning, I want you to think about this question. Why do we work? And yes, this could be generically why we work at anything, whether you're talking about housework or yard work or whatever. But we're mainly asking this question in terms of why do we work at a job? Well, I want you to think about the answer to that question. Let your mind sort of just brainstorm silently. Several things may pass through it. You may think, well, you work so that you can earn a living, so you can have the physical necessities for yourself and for your family, food, clothing, shelter, etc. You may think in terms of personal goals. You know, I always wanted to be a fireman. I always wanted to, repair computers. I love working with computers or something like that. It may be accomplishments. Well, I always wanted to have my own company with people working for me. It may be pleasure of the task. Somebody might love to work with wood, and so that's why they're a carpenter. Somebody may love working with children, and so that's why they work in a school or a daycare or preschool or something like that. There are a lot of different reasons why we may attach as to why we work. Is there anything else beyond those things? Well, I want you to consider that with me this morning. You know, good or bad, our jobs consume a lot of our lives and our identity. Both. I mean, just think about the matter of time, just how many hours we spend a day, a week, employed with our occupation. It's significant. And then there's the question, you know, that people often pop. Well, what do you do? Think about that question. What do you do? Well, what do I do? I'm standing. I do that. You know, I just got up from a chair. I do that. We know what that means. What do you do? I mean, what do you do for a living? Even that expression, what do you do for a living? We know what that means. What's your job? We don't usually say that. We usually say, what do you do? Or what do you do for a living? Or where do you work even? That you're tied to a place or an organization. Which all of that has to do with our identity. You first get to know somebody and you're trying to learn something about them. And so this question comes up early because we understand it's part of a person's identity. And if there's ever a place where people live where this is so, it's certainly in the Washington, D.C. metro area. I mean, think about it. How many of you are not from here? Why are you here? Job brought you, right? That's true of so many. There's some exceptions here to that, okay? I mean, like these people right down here, they got dragged here by somebody, okay? But so many of you are not from here, which is typical of the Washington metro area. And the reason why you came, probably more than 90% of the time, is because of a job. Some kind of career move or opportunity. And in this area, it is a chief determinant of your status, even. Where you work, or what you work in, what kind of job you have. But do we ever stop and ask the question, what's the purpose of this? Why am I working? Where is this job taking me? How often do we stop and consider what's the whole point and where this is headed? Well, the Bible helps. The Bible helps a lot when it comes to this. Because, you know, if it's something that's so consuming, something that's so broad, the Bible's going to have something very important to say about it. I want you to first consider with me several statements, mainly from the Old Testament here at first, about work. And I have these on the screen. As you consider this question of, you know, where is my job taking me and what the Bible has to say as we answer that. And we really start at the start. We start at the beginning. Genesis tells us with the first man, in Genesis chapter, that should be chapter 2, I apologize, that the Lord took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. Genesis chapter 2. We were made to work. This should be Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. I apologize. We were made to work, to tend and cultivate it. I'm sure a lot of people's concept of the Garden of Eden, that there was this, God made this Garden of Eden. He also put this big hammock in it. And then after Eve came along, there was a his and hers. Had a bit A on one, a big E on the other one, or something like that. And that was the whole deal. No. Adam was in the garden to tend and keep the garden. We're made to work, to have occupation, to fix things, to build, create. Think about it. God made the world, and then He made mankind in His image, and then He said, now I've turned the world over to you. You work with it now. I've made it. Now you work with it. And we talk about, and I think in a way, appropriately, that we, God has made this world, and we keep working with it, and we keep doing the things God does. Maintain it, create things within it. Everything that man comes up with, every creation he comes up with, every gadget, every technological advancement, it's just building on God's work. And so we're made to do this. Work is not a bad thing. It's part of God's original design. But believe you me, things did get messed up. And that's what this second reference is about in Genesis chapter 3. Where after Adam and Eve sin, there are curses. Including this curse to Adam about work. Cursed is the ground because of you. And toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Think about it. He was put in the garden to tend and keep it. Human beings at first were agrarian. This was so for many, many centuries. It stands for our work, our occupation. And look what happens. It's cursed. Both thorns and thistles, it shall grow for you. It will eat the plants, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face, you will eat bread. Till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, and for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. That now this relationship we're going to have with the earth, in this working with the earth that we're going to have, is going to be difficult. Thorns and thistles. Sweat. And so you've got effort, and you've got strain, and you're fighting obstacles the whole time. Work now. It's cursed. There will be impediments. There will be things working against you as you work. And this is so with any kind of work, whether it's a paid job or not. Is this true today? It is. Is any job as good as you thought it was going to be? Is any job as easy as you thought it was going to be? Do projects go as smoothly as you anticipate? Maybe sometimes more smoothly than you anticipate. But usually they have thorns and thistles in them, don't they? Do coworkers, employees, employers, machines, and plans work as well as you would like them to work all the time? Let's play a little word association. Tell me what your reaction. Don't tell me what your reaction is, but think about your reaction here to these words. So don't let out any kind of screams or anything like that, but just consider your reaction to these words. Proposal. Deadline. Annual review. Copier. They've gotten a lot better, but still. And remember the early ones? Okay. I mean, what's a copier for? To bang your head against. I mean, it's really the purpose of it. It's something that, you know, it's better than a wall. But for those things, when I name those things, you either roll your eyes or you tense up. Maybe you had a spike in blood pressure. Okay. It's no different today, even though we work with copiers and computers and things like that. We're made to work, but now we're in a world where our work is going to be frustrating. Well, we understand that, but maybe there's something that's going to come out of it that will, you know, make up for it. Well, consider some statements from Ecclesiastes, where in chapter 9, the wise man says, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not swift, nor battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. Now, these are metaphors to talk about how that, you know, the most talented and the most deserving don't always get what they should get. There's an injustice to life. But look at the kinds of metaphors and think about work and occupations and even jobs. Bread to the wise. Now, bread here means you work for your bread. You work for your food, okay? And we, even in the 20th century, we used to have, not so much now, an expression in American vernacular that bread was money. Give me some bread. That was a nickname for cash, for money. And it's so appropriate. You work for bread. Man has always worked for bread, one way or the other. And you got to have cash to buy real bread. And bread even stands for food, even in the Bible. Where the bread's not always to the wise. Nor riches to men of understanding. Look at this. Nor favor to men of skill. You hone your skills. You get your training. You get your education. But you don't always get favor. This is another dimension to the frustration of work. Do you ever cease to be amazed in your job at how incompetent people are so successful? It is humorous. I knew I'd get a laugh out of that. It's better to laugh than to cry about it. Sometimes you cry about it. Have you ever wondered why some people are promoted and some people aren't? It is a mystery. What are they doing there? Now, it's true. Usually, if you work hard and do things right, things go fairly well. But we understand there are plenty of exceptions to that. And those exceptions sometimes are so difficult to deal with. It is not, as this passage is indicating, an equitable system. Earth is not an equitable system. And when it comes to our work, it's not an equitable system. Well, maybe, you know, even though life is frustrating and even those things are not just inequitable, there's always something we can get out of our work, especially something tangible. And that goes back to why we oftentimes work. But consider Ecclesiastes and consider this man who was so successful and had so many possessions. And he says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. And thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, work, and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. And this man was rich and successful and powerful and had political power. He was a king. But still he had work and he had tasks and he had plans and he had actions and he implemented these things and he accomplished things and he built things and he acquired things. And when it was all done, he said it was like grasping for the wind. In other words, he didn't get as much out of it as he thought he was going to. It was not nearly as fulfilling as he thought it was going to be. That it didn't satisfy. Well, somebody may say, well, you know, that's true. I may not make as much money as I'd like to make, but even if I make that amount of money and I buy the things I want to buy, you know, they're not going to be as fulfilling and the new is going to wear off and all those kinds of things. But at least I can acquire some things and leave it. Well, he experienced that too. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. Yet he'll have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I've labored by acting wisely under the sun. This to his vanity. This might mean your heirs. You save up and leave it to your children and grandchildren. And when you die, you have no control over it. They may do well with it or they may ruin it. This may be with a company you build up. You decide to sell it. Or land, some you built this big estate. And Al and I were talking about Steve Jobs a while ago. He's reading a book about it. I mean, who's controlling everything Steve Jobs built up? Not Steve Jobs anymore. Somebody else is. Somebody else is going to control it. He has no control over it now. None. Not at all. As smart and successful as he was, it's out of his hands now. And as the wise man observed, that's vanity too. No wonder he said in Ecclesiastes 6, verse 7, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite's not satisfied. What's this telling us, these passages? Well, work is a necessary thing, but it's hard and exasperating. Any kind of work and occupation or activity and labor. We're never going to accomplish all we desire in our careers. It's going to be elusive. We're never going to get everything out of it that we want to get out of it, whether it's personal satisfaction and accomplishment or the level we want to reach, because once we reach one level, we're not satisfied with that. And even what we physically acquire will not eventually satisfy, nor will it last. At some point, it's going to run out, play out, give out. It's just not going to do it. So you're thinking, what is the point of work? It's something we got to do, but it's so hard, so frustrating, so empty, so vain. What's the point of it? Is it like being a mouse on a treadmill? If that's all there is, that's sort of a sad and tragic depiction, isn't it? But there is more. And this is where the Bible helps us to see it. We start with the very elementary things. Now we turn to the New Testament. We'll come back to the Old Testament. But look in 1 Timothy chapter 5, where the Apostle Paul is writing, and he's instructing Timothy to instruct these Christians in these local churches. And he says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now the context here were Christians who had needy mothers and grandmothers. And they were looking for the church to take care of them. And those sorry sons and daughters and irresponsible grandsons and granddaughters were not taking care of their mothers and grandmothers. And they said, well, it's the church's responsibility. And what Paul says, listen, it's their responsibility. Now, obviously, if nobody takes care of a mother or grandmother, the church should do it. But what Paul is saying here is these people who claim to be believers don't take care of their mothers and grandmothers physically. They're worse than an unbeliever. They're worse than somebody who denies God. That's real strong language. I want you to not just understand here that he's saying you need to provide for your own. Look how he couches it. If you don't, he couches it in moral and spiritual terms. And we all understand that to provide for your own, you have to earn a living. See how that's connected to your job? Now, he continues, Paul does in his writings, and he says about work over in Ephesians 4, in verse 28, let him who still no longer. He's talking about people who now are converted to Christ. They have a changed life. And here's what you should do. But rather let him labor, working with his hands, what is good, that he may have something to give to him who has need. And the context here is not your family necessarily, but somebody you encounter who has a legitimate need, and now you've worked, you've been blessed with these, you know, with acquiring these funds and these possessions and this food or whatever, and you give it to those who have need. You share it with those who have need. You take care of your own, and then you help even others who have need. Now, these may not appear to be grandiose reasons to take care of your family and anybody that you encounter who has a need. But they're important. And they are related to our relationship and even our contentment with their jobs. You know, when somebody goes to buy a car, it's easy to get distracted with other things. Look at the color of it. Or how it handles on the road. How it takes the bumps. Or, you know, how comfortable the seats are. Or how convenient the controls are located on the panel or even how the stereo sounds. But when it comes right down to it, on a cold February morning, and you get in the car at 7 o'clock and you got to be at work in 30 minutes, or you're on a trip with your family, you know what really is going to matter? Two things, that engine and that transmission. That's really the crux of that car. Now, you can throw in brakes or something like that, but you got my point. It's okay, engine, transmission, and brakes. But when you walk into a lot to look at a car, your mind, man, I want to check out the brakes on this thing. Oftentimes we get distracted. the fundamentals are the things like what makes it go, what makes it stop. Well, providing for your family and helping out others in need, those may not be as flashy. Those are basic, but they're needed, and they're fundamental. And really thinking about how that's really why one of the reasons we work, two of the reasons we work, helps us. And that's where we moderns have gotten so far away from that. In the ancient world, a lot of people had to work hard just to do these things. They worked as hard as they could work, and this is all they were able to do, no more. In modern times, especially in the West, we don't have to work very many hours to cover the expenses of those two things. And so we begin to look at our work and our occupations as something where we can accomplish more than just feed our families and have some money to help out some other people and have some extra clothes to give to somebody in need or a blanket or whatever. We begin to think there's more to it. Because after all, we've got so much excess left over. And that's where we really fall into a trap. And we learn the bitter taste of those things that the Ecclesiastes writer tasted. It's not quite as satisfying, and it's not lasting like I thought it was going to be. Because there's another reason why we work. Those are biblical reasons. Take care of our own and help those who have a need that we encounter. The Bible says a lot about another reason. Consider these passages, going back to the Old Testament. Proverbs chapter 11, verse 1. The wise man writes, "Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight." This is talking about a business transaction. In ancient times, you went to the market and they weighed out so much wheat for you or so much olive oil for you. Then the person who's selling it, they had a set of scales. And a dishonest businessman would have his scales fixed, where you got less than you encounter. You ever pump gas? Probably never noticed this. There's a sticker on that gas pump. If not, don't pump gas there. There's a sticker on that gas pump from the state where they inspect that pump every now and then to make sure it's pumping out a gallon when it says a gallon and not 9/10 of a gallon and cheating you. They didn't have those kinds of things back then. And so here's a businessman who's got his scales fixed where he's cheating his customers. He's getting money off them and not giving them the right amount of the product. And that goes both ways. Somebody can buy something off somebody and try to, you know, put more on the scale than should be. Oh, did you put a pound on there? Yeah, I put a pound on there. They got a pound and a half. Even this whole concept is the idea of commerce and honest commerce. It's like at a cash register. Giving the right amount of change and not cheating the customer. Or the customer who got back too much and you don't give it back. It's commercial activity. And it's being honest. And look what it says. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord. This is Old Testament language. The Old Testament talks about abominations, right? What's an abomination? It's where you do something out of disrespect to God. It's irreverence to God. It's dishonoring God. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord. Strong language, isn't it? Back to the New Testament. There were some Thessalonians who thought Jesus was coming any day now. Some of them evidently had stopped working. He says in 1 Thessalonians 4, "But you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, that you may walk properly toward those who are outside and that you may lack nothing." Look what is connected to doing your work. You do your work. Whatever your work is, do it. What's it connected to? What Paul commanded. Paul was not a financial advisor. He was not a life coach. He's giving them teaching from God for their soul's sake. But that included them being faithful, reliable, working people. And that this is connected to walking properly. This is the New Testament epistles expression for living. If you want to live a proper life, here's some things you've got to do. Do your work. Do your work. Meet your responsibilities. Evidently, even after writing this letter, some were not. So Paul had to get heavier in his instructions. In the second letter, he writes in the third chapter, "For even when we were with you, we commanded you this. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies." These are people who are not meeting their responsibilities, not doing their work, not taking care of their business, and they're running around in everybody else's business, mooching off other people. If these people aren't working, you don't feed them. He's not describing people who were sick and ailing or elderly or wounded and needed help. No. We have examples in the New Testament of needy widows getting help from brethren and things like that. These are people who were able-bodied, not working. Paul says if they're not going to work, don't feed them. And he continues here in the same chapter and talks about how that if these people continue in this, as a Christian, you need to cut off your fellowship. This is one of the texts that talk about withdrawing your fellowship from a Christian who is living an unfaithful, ungodly life. And in this context, the unfaithfulness, the ungodliness, was not working and mooching off the brethren and expecting other people to feed you when you won't get up and work. See what it is? It's a moral issue. It's a spiritually connected issue. Pretty strong language. Going back to Proverbs, the wise man says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise." The book of Proverbs is written to make us wise. To make us wise, not just in the standpoint that we get the advantages on earth, but rather we live the right kind of life before God. A wise life is a righteous life and a godly life in the book of Proverbs. And he says, "Go to the ant. Look at these ants. They scurry around and work all the time." If you mimic that example, you'll be wise. Look what this is saying about our work. You demonstrate your dependability, your honesty, when you work. And it's one of the fundamental goals when it comes to the Bible. The Bible teaches us we work for these reasons right here. To provide for our family. To have funds to help with those who we encounter who have legitimate needs. And then to prove our moral faithfulness. Those are the biblical career goals. They don't teach this in the business schools. But this is God's version of what your career goals should be. And we should apply this to any kind of work that we do. And I really want you to think about this last part, those last passages we read, like from Proverbs and 1 and 2 Thessalonians and 1 Timothy. And look at the perspective that the Bible is teaching us to have regarding our work. It's a moral test. You know, those statements about abomination of the Lord and the honest scales, about being worse than an unbeliever, about walking properly and all those kinds of things. It's a moral test. Work presses us and pushes us and challenges us. And in it, we've got to make choices. In work, our values get exposed. Rick and I were having a conversation just a few days ago. I forgot exactly how it came up. We're talking about work. That's what it was. And we just made the comment to each other that there are two people you can't fool. People you live with in your family and the people you work with. And you can fool people here at church. You can fool them. Especially if you don't spend much time with them, you just pop in here occasionally. You can fool people in your neighborhood. I mean, you can sort of shroud your true character in certain situations in life. But if you live in a home with somebody, your real self comes out. And if you work day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year with people, they get to know what you're made of. They know what kind of morality that you have. And you don't have to set out to show them who you are. You just do that job, they'll see it. It just comes out. It's a reflection of your character, your moral character. In your work, you have to make these decisions. You know, do I care more about people or my position? Am I about principle or about advancement? It happens all the time. All kinds of little and big decisions. It's even a window, especially consider it from a Christian standpoint, it's a window into your relationship with God. No doubt, and I hope this doesn't stress you out, you have this tomorrow or something, you have quarterly reports that come out in the company. Maybe you have to contribute to the report yourself. You have annual reviews. You have sales numbers. All those kinds of things that come out, and they're constantly, measuring your performance, your group's performance, your office's performance, your sector's performance, whatever. You're getting measured all the time. And it's about those productivity numbers, sales, retentions of clients, from a manufacturing standpoint, how many units were produced in that amount of time, all those kinds of things. It's very quantitative. Well, you know what? God has a report too on you. He has quarterly reports and annual reviews. And in the end, He's going to have the final judgment. Based on those passages we read from Proverbs, 1 Timothy, and 1 and 2 Thessalonians, God is measuring us and judging us regarding the character and the behavior we have in our work. And it does not have anything to do with sales figures or units produced. It's about character. And in the long run, what will matter is not the numbers you produce, but the character you showed. And certainly this is with God. But it is, period. Even the people you work with, years from now, what will matter is not so much what you produced from the job standpoint, but how you treated them. The kind of person you were, the kind of character you showed. Responsible and reliable. Honest and fair. Helpful and kind. Respectful, unselfish. Those are the real measuring sticks. For other people, even, in the long run. But most especially for God. And what this is teaching us is our work. And I think all of us need this. Probably males more than females. But all of us need this. Work is about character, not ego. It's easy to tie our work to our value. After all, a price is actually put on our work. A price is put on our performance. He's worth X amount a year because of what he does for the company. Oh, in this quarter, he brought in this much, so he got the bonus or he got commissions. And so you're constantly, there's a tag that's being put on you. And it's easy to think that that number is your worth. It's not. It's easy to think that we have to prove ourselves through our work. Well, by doing this in the job and being really good at this in the job and producing this in my job, I'm going to show them who I am. I'm going to show them I'm important. I'm going to show them I'm just as good as anybody else. And we think in those terms, we begin to think that we are going to prove ourselves in that job performance. Listen, we should gain our self-value from our relationship with God. That's where our value comes from. So that one day we retire, or the company closes its doors and we get, severed, It doesn't rock us. Because I'm not an accountant, and that's it. I'm not a sales manager, and that's it. I'm me. I'm a Christian. I'm a child of God. I belong to God. And irregardless of those circumstances, that's where my value is. That's where my identity is. That's what makes me me, and that's all that matters. And the only thing in this life we have to prove is our love for God. That's the only thing we have to prove. We don't have to prove anything to our boss, our co-workers. And you know what? This is odd. If you're not in a position of management, you don't think in these terms. You think that it's always the employee having an implicit employer. But listen, it's just as bad the other way. Sometimes it's the employer. Sometimes it's the manager. Sometimes it's the CEO who's trying to impress the people under him or her. Goes both ways. But you don't have anything to prove to anybody at work. The only thing you have to do is prove your love for God. And one way you do that is by being the kind of person that He wants you to be in your work. That reliable, faithful, honest, dependable, unselfish, kind, principled person. That's the only thing you have to prove in your work. Is your faithfulness to God. Because you love Him. So I want you to look at that list. It's real simple, you know. Family, others in need, and your character. What if you had these as your career goals, your work goals? How would that impact the typical frustrations you have at work? Don't the typical frustrations then shrink? And don't they become so much more manageable to deal with? You see, if there are other reasons besides these right here, these biblical reasons, if there are other reasons why you're working that's really driving you in your work, you're going to get frustrated. And you're going to come up empty. And your career is not going to satisfy you. It's going to eat on you. It's what it's going to do. The Bible is teaching us, and that's why that set of passages at first, from Genesis and Ecclesiastes, the Bible is teaching us that we can expect too much out of our work. If you expect your work to give you self-esteem and value and complete satisfaction and accomplishment, you're setting yourself up. You're expecting too much out of it. But look at this list. Provide for family. Have something to help those who have needs around you. And then improve your moral character as a follower of God by His principles and His ways, His teaching. You know what? Every one of those things are attainable. And every one of those things are under your control. It doesn't matter how stupid your boss is. It doesn't matter how poorly run the company is. It doesn't matter if the company's got millions of dollars it's sitting on or if it's leveraged to the point that it can't move. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're working with the biggest buffoons. If you've got the Three Stooges around you at work, it doesn't matter. You got control of those things right there. And every one of those things are attainable. Do you see what the Bible teaches us here? It's teaching us a wise path to take, a wise way of looking at our work and our jobs. And one through which our work experience and our patient experience, it can be a fulfilling thing. And the reason why is we're just simply doing what God wants us to do in it. And when we do that in anything, it's immensely fulfilling. You know, having the right principles and doing things God's way, and even though it can be scary and difficult, can mean that even when you're fired for doing the right thing, you can still feel good about it. satisfy if you're rewarded for doing the wrong thing. But these are your goals. You feel rotten about it. What a great way to see the value of biblical wisdom. The Bible has immense wisdom to share with us regarding things and experiences and needs and questions and challenges we have every day. And we need to take the time to hear the Bible out and to listen to it closely and understand it and then to heed that wisdom. Because it is of such great value to our lives, and God cared enough about us to share it with us. And we need to care enough about Him to listen to Him, follow His wisdom, even when it comes to our work. Well, Rick has selected only a step which prompts our thoughts in terms of where our soul is before God and realizing how that our sins separate us from God. But if we're willing to step toward Him, He is willing to meet us more than halfway, because He's done that by giving His own Son on the cross. If you're ready to make the step of commitment to become a Christian today by obeying the gospel of Jesus, by deciding to repent of sin because you've decided that Jesus is the Christ and the Lord, and you want to confess that and step toward Him and step and walk with Him, then today we can baptize you into Christ and you can become His follower and the child of God. If you need to respond to the invitation anyway, won't you come? We stand and sing.